It's Tuesday, March 29th, 2022, and I call this meeting of the House Higher Education Committee to order. The CLA will take the roll.
Chair Bernardi.
Present.
Bernardi, present. Vice Chair Christensen.
Present.
Christensen, present. Representative O'Neill.
O'Neill, present.
O'Neill, present. Representative Albright.
Present.
Albright, present. Representative Daniels.
Daniels, present.
Daniels, present. Representative Erickson.
Erickson, present.
Erickson, present. Representative Hansen.
Hansen, present.
Hansen, present. Representative Heintzman.
Present.
Heintzman, present. Representative Howard.
Howard, present.
Howard, present. Representative Keeler.
Keeler, present.
Keeler, present. Representative Cleborne.
Cleborne, present.
Cleborne, present. Representative Kosnick.
Present.
Kosnick, present. Representative Crenshaw. Representative Crenshaw. Representative Mason. Representative Mason. Representative Meckland. Representative Meckland. Representative Noor. Representative Noor. Representative Sandell.
Present.
Sandell, present. Representative Sandsted.
Present.
Sandsted, present. Representative Thompson.
Thompson, present.
Thompson, present. Representative Crenshaw. Representative Mason. Representative Meckland. Representative Noor. Madam Chair, a quorum is present. Madam Chair, you're on mute.
Thank you. Next, may I have a motion to approve the minutes for March 23rd, 2022?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Representative Stansted moves approval of the minutes for March 23rd, 2022. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes for March 23rd, 2022 are approved. First on the agenda, we have House File 4415 from Representative Wolgamott. We have 20 minutes scheduled for this bill and we will plan to wrap up at 3:25. I will move that House File 4415 be laid over for possible inclusion. We have before us House File 4415. Representative Wolgamott has an author's amendment labeled A1. I will move the A1 amendment to put the bill in the form the author wants. Representative Wolgamott, can you tell us briefly what this amendment is about?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members. Always great to be back in the Higher Education Committee. I'm moving this amendment. It's a technical amendment that I worked on in consultation with Minnesota State. It simply clarifies the word from technologist to scientist to be consistent with how they describe that in other areas of their description. So just a technical thing in consultation with Mint State.
Thank you. Is there any discussion to the amendment? All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. We have before us House File 4415. Representative Wolgamott, please present your bill to the committee.
Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. I am here this afternoon to present House File 4415, which is a bill to create one-time scholarships to invest in and recruit Minnesota's future health professionals and tackle the issue of long-term healthcare worker shortages that we're seeing. Madam Chair and members, we are at crisis levels. 1 in 5 total job vacancies in Minnesota are currently healthcare. In fact, the Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development estimates that there are currently 40,000 total healthcare job vacancies in our state, including 6,000 vacancies in allied health occupations. And among these, there are 1,400 open positions for medical laboratory professionals, respiratory therapists, radiology technicians, and surgical technicians. And this number is only projected to grow with an additional 10,000 vacancies for these professionals projected between now and 2030. So that's why we're bringing this bill forward, Madam Chair and members. What this bill does is it seeks to support educational scholarships for those professions, for lab professionals, respiratory therapists, radiology technicians, and surgical technicians. It will reward 1,000 scholarships of $5,000 each in an effort to attract 1,000 individuals to these health professions. This is a one-time appropriation, Madam Chair, and it is for new students, so high schoolers or other young adults out there looking to get into this field. It is eligible for any accredited Minnesota higher education institution. And we also have some funding for the promotion of the program and the administration of the program. And again, it's a one-time appropriation, and the first scholarships will be rewarded for the 2023-2024 academic year. So that's the bill, and I've got a testifier here. With your permission, Madam Chair, Mr. Danny Ackert, from the who's the Director of State Government Relations from the Minnesota Hospital Association.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Ackert. Please state your name for the record and please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Danny Ackert with the Minnesota Hospital Association. It is well documented, as Representative Wolfmott pointed out, that the COVID-19 pandemic has placed an enormous amount of stress on the entire healthcare workforce. The Minnesota Department of Health documented in a recent survey that from the start of the pandemic, healthcare job vacancies are increasing. The share of providers planning to leave their jobs in the next 5 years is increasing, specifically in rural areas. And the Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development estimates that there are currently 40,000 healthcare job vacancies in Minnesota, or put another way, as Representative Wolfmott pointed out, that there are 1 in 5 vacancies right now, is in healthcare. One field of the healthcare workforce that is sometimes overlooked, but by no means any less important to the care team in delivering services to Minnesotans, is allied health technicians. These are critical professions in healthcare that valiantly served during the pandemic. For example, respiratory therapists, also known as your neighbor, your family member, or the person that you crossed paths with in the grocery store last night or this week, were running the respirators on the COVID ICU units around the clock. The ventilators. The laboratory professionals, same instance, same relations, they were doing all the COVID-19 tests, not only for the last 2 years have they been critical, but for the care before COVID, during COVID, and into the future. And needless to say, they are essential. They are on the front lines of patient care, and they are in high demand. However, they too are experiencing shortages, and based on a February 2022 snapshot, from the Minnesota State's Health Force Center for Excellence, there are only 1,400 open allied health technician jobs, laboratory professionals, respiratory therapists, radiology technicians, and surgical technicians. And the number is going to increase. For those 4 allied health professions alone, it is projected that between now and 2030, the year 2030, there will be an additional 10,000 vacancies in those positions across the state. But solving for the workforce shortage in healthcare is necessary and require various approaches and investments specifically in higher ed. Our goal with House File 4415 is to begin the multi-year process to recruit a new cohort of allied health technicians by establishing a one-time scholarship program for students newly enrolled in an accredited allied health technician program in Minnesota for the 2023-24 academic school years. Each scholarship will total $5,000, with the goal to award 1,000 scholarships to individuals pursuing a career specifically as a laboratory professional, respiratory therapist, radiology technician, or surgical technician. The proposed scholarship program is modeled after the successful 1,000 CNA program, quote unquote, currently underway at the Office of Higher Ed, and will build off the positive experience that Minnesota State has developed in marketing and administering that program. Filling the many current opportunities for a career in healthcare in Minnesota requires personal and public investment in higher education. Student education costs are a real barrier, but one that we know that scholarships help overcome. To close, I want to thank Chair Bernardi for hearing this bill, bringing it before the committee. And I also want to thank Representative Wolgamott for working hard as our chief author. So I ask for your support on this bill, and I stand for questions.
Great, thank you. We have four members with their hands up, and we have till 3:20 for this, roughly till 3:25. So Representative O'Neill.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. So in full disclosure, my daughter is an RTR. So she's a radiologist technician trained at Dunwoody. And I happen to know that Dunwoody is one of the premier places that trains RTRs. But here's my question. I know that her class was only 10. They train 10 at a time. This bill is for 1,000 students. Now, that's just one of the many categories. So I'm wondering if the author of the bill could explain how we got to 1,000. I'm not sure what kind of capacity there is in some of these other fields, but I know for RTR you could maybe train 20 or maybe 25. There's another program a year. So I'm just wondering how he got to 1,000.
Representative Wolgamott.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative O'Neill. Thank you for that incredible life-saving work that your daughter does. That's real impressive and reflects well on you as a parent, Representative O'Neill. As far as how we got to 1,000, again, as I mentioned in my opening presentation, based on estimate from DEED, we are currently, there are 1,400 open positions in these areas for medical lab professionals, respiratory therapists, radiology technicians, and surgical technicians. And this, according to the study, that number is projected to continue to grow with an additional 10,000 vacancies for these professions projected between now and 2030. So we're just taking a look at what the numbers are for what the need is and trying to use this bill to get more young people interested in pursuing these careers.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, precisely my question. So what you actually need to do is not find out how many vacancies there are. You need to find out what is the capacity in the higher ed system to train people in these specific areas. I don't know the number. I was hoping you, since you brought this forward, would know that number. Because what you need to do is look at your five areas. So medical lab tech, medical lab scientist, respiratory therapist, radiologist, technician, and surgical tech, and find out of the different institutions that actually do this work and train these people, how many do they train at a time? I gave you one example. The radiologist technician program at Dunwoody will train 10 at a time, and there's a very explicit reason why they do that. And they're the premier trainers of radiologist technicians. There is another program. They train a few more, but they're not as highly rated and they're not as highly as sought after when you get into the hospitals to try to get a job. So I would suggest that before you come forward with a bill with a specific number, that you go the other direction and find out what is even the capacity to train in these specific areas. Again, I don't know what it is. I just happen to know that in RTR, there's just a few openings a year and they're very, very highly sought after. They're very difficult to get into. So that would be my suggestion. I'd really like to know what that number is. And I'm assuming this is going to be a laid over. I didn't really hear what that was, but we really need to know what is even the capacity in the higher ed system. Thank you, Madam.
Representative Albright.
Oh, excuse me, Madam Chair.
Representative Wolgamott.
I believe that my testifier, Mr. Acker, can provide further information for Representative O'Neill, if you would be kind enough to give him the floor.
Mr. Acker.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative O'Neill, for your question. Oh, I do not have those numbers at the top of my head, but we have worked with Minnesota State to kind of establish this number. As Representative Wolgamott pointed out, we're at a deficit and a growing deficit with open vacancies for these jobs. Our intent is to work with Minn State and the Office of Higher Ed with the appropriation of this bill that has money to market and attract the right people to the right programs. So with their experience and with the 1,000 CNA program and with their ongoing experience with recruiting people to come to their programs, that would be able to assess and figure out who is, what capacity they have, and go after the right people for those programs. So, We've also talked with Minnesota State Health Force Center of Excellence, and they have open capacity. And I've looked at the numbers that you're referencing that Deed has, and I'm happy to follow up with those. There's open capacity in positions or in these fields in Minnesota State. I can follow up with that.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Madam Chair, Representative Olgamut, could you point me to the provision in your bill where it stipulates that the graduates of these programs will take jobs in Minnesota?
Representative Olgamut.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Albright. We can't force people to work in a particular place, but on line 2.3, one of the requirements to be eligible for the scholarship is to submit to the commissioner a completed affidavit affirming the student's intent to work in these specified fields. And we know that our higher learning institutions have strong partnerships and relationships with Minnesota medical facilities and the hospitals and places where we need these workers. So we can't force people to be in Minnesota, but we do know that by getting more students interested in these professions and by utilizing the resources that are available in Minnesota's institutions of higher education and the partnerships that they have with healthcare providers, we know that this will go a long way into solving this workforce shortage.
Representative Albright, do you have a follow-up?
I do, and more of a comment. Representative Olgamut, I would take exception with your point that we can't force people to work in Minnesota. We do it all the time with scholarships based on their retention of the work in Minnesota for a said period of time. So your intentions are good, but what I think the one of the outcomes of this is very likely that we will be training the workforces for surrounding states based upon the taxpayers of Minnesota fronting the bill. So to your efforts, not only make sure that the slots are open for these folks, but make sure that we're training people that are gonna fulfill the demand for positions in Minnesota, not in neighboring states. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative
Wolgamott. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Albright. We're laying this bill over, so I would be more than happy to work with you on language that, that can make sure that we are advancing the goal of getting more people working and filling these jobs in our state. So you'll appreciate the comment, and sounds like we've got the same goal and the same objective here, so would absolutely welcome the opportunity to work with you to make sure that we're fulfilling that goal. Thank you, Representative Albright, Madam Chair.
Representative Daniels.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question was actually answered by my sister, Representative O'Neill. I was wondering how many, we have a problem getting police officers in Alexander Tech. They normally have about 355 students per year, and they're down to about 120, 125. And I just didn't know, if we throw the money at it, $5.3 million, are we going to get enough seats in the butts in the seats? And then Representative Albright had a great point that we need to tighten up that language. So if we do pay part of the bill for them to do this, that at least we can be expected to say in Minnesota for, most bills are 3, 4, 5 years required to serve in Minnesota. So most of my questions are answered, but I have one comment. And that would be, it seems like we have an awful lot of requests for spending, and this is not a budget year. Remind the committee that this is not a budget year. So even though we have a lot of federal money thrown around that kind of puts a lot of more money in the pot, that will run out eventually. And what I don't want to be is be set up for failure to have a deficit in 2 or 3 years. So I just like to maybe caution all the committees that are presenting huge amounts of spending that this money's not going to be around forever. So that was my comment. I think the effort is good. I just think we need to see if we have enough bucks to put in the seats and if we can get those, once they're trained, get them to stay in Minnesota. So that was my comments. And I just thank you for the time, Madam Chair.
Okay, welcome. Representative Wolgamott.
Thanks, Madam Chair, and I appreciate those comments, Representative Daniels. And again, I don't want to do anything that is going to leave us in deficit either here. I just would like to remind the committee that this is a one-time appropriation, and it actually sunsets on June 30th of 2025. So we share those concerns in that goal, Representative Daniels.
Okay, we have one more question, it looks like. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a point of information for all of us in the area of healthcare workers. Nursing homes have 23,000 openings. 23,000 folks are needed for healthcare in our nursing homes. So we need to keep that in mind too.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Wolgamott, would you like to make closing remarks on your bill?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members. I appreciate your consideration for this bill and want to continue to work with each and every one of you to earn your support to make sure that we are solving this healthcare workforce shortage crisis that we're in. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Wolgamott. Hearing no further discussion, I will renew my motion that House File 4415, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion. The bill is laid over. Thank you. Nice to have you back, Representative Wolgamott. Goodbye. Okay, so next on the agenda, we have House File 3552 from Representative Cagle. We have 20 minutes scheduled for this bill, and we plan to wrap up about 3:40, 3:45. And I will move that House File 3552 be laid over for possible inclusion. We have before us House File 3552. Representative Cagle, please present your bill to the committee. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Thank you for scheduling the Addiction Medicine Fellowship bill again. I'm proud to author House File 3552, which funds the only addiction medicine fellowship program in the state. This program is housed at the University of Minnesota's Department of Psychiatric and Hennepin County Medical Center's Addiction Medicine Department. There are 21 million Americans who suffer from substance use disorder, and there is a lack of specialty trained addiction medicine physicians to treat them. Only 11% of people suffering with a substance use disorder are being treated for their addiction, and in Minnesota, there are over 30 rural counties that do not have a single provider that has obtained federal approval to prescribe certain medications for their treatment. We all know that the COVID-19 pandemic has increased mental health and substance use disorders. We've seen a 30% increase in overdose deaths, which in Minnesota, and that mimics national trends. This 12-month program trains physicians to become experts in the prevention, clinical evaluation, treatment, and ongoing care of those with addiction using evidence-based therapies. Continuing to fund the Addiction Medicine Fellowship Program will strengthen the healthcare workforce and incentivize specialists to train and stay in Minnesota. I ask for your support in training more experts in the field of addiction right here in Minnesota. With me, I have Dr. Sheila Spector, who is the director of the program, and Dr. Brian Grahan, who is a graduate of the program now working in addiction medicine at HCMC. We also have a one-pager and letter of support from HCMC's Chief of Addiction Medicine. With that, I'll turn it over to my testifiers.
Thank you very much. Dr. Sheila Spector, if you could please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me to testify on House File 3552. My name is Dr. Sheila Spector, and I am a practicing addiction psychiatrist at the University of Minnesota and the program director of the Minnesota Addiction Medicine Fellowship, which is shared between the University of Minnesota, Hennepin County Medical Center, and the VA Medical Center. I also want to thank Representative Cagle for again authoring legislation for our only addiction medicine fellowship in the state. As Representative Cagle mentioned, of the 21 million Americans with an addiction, there are under 2,000 physicians that are specially trained. This is one reason why there are only about 1 in 10 persons with the substance use disorder who receive treatment in the United States. And this number has really not increased very significantly. In Minnesota, there are less than half of the counties that have no physicians with the federal approval to treat opioid use disorder, a highly effective medication known as buprenorphine. We're acutely aware of the skyrocketing overdose deaths from synthetic opioids in particular, and the racial disparity is even more dramatic. The pandemic has triggered an increase in alcohol use, methamphetamine, and other substances as well. This 12-month program began in 1982, and I was one of the early graduates of the program, and trains physicians to become experts in prevention, evaluation, treatment, and ongoing care of persons with addiction throughout the lifespan, from prenatal to adolescence to geriatrics, using evidence-based therapies. There are medication-assisted therapies, in and outpatient therapies, and therapies for co-occurring psychiatric problems. The one of the goals of the program is to train physicians to be leaders and educators for other physicians, as we could never serve the entire state of Minnesota with three graduates per year. Nearly all of our graduates are practicing in Minnesota. Some are in academic settings and training others, such as Hennepin County Medical Center, the university, and the VA Medical Center, and others in rural community and underserved areas. Dr. Graham, who will be testifying next, is one such graduate. The program recently obtained full accreditation from the Accreditation Council for Graduate Medical Education, which also recently approved an increase in the number of positions because of the great need to expand the workforce. Each year, the program struggles to cover the resident, the fellow stipends due to lack of sustainable funding. The GME residency and fellowship programs are funded through federal dollars, but there are only a fixed number of slots, and there are not enough funds for fellowships, and specifically addiction fellowships. Each year we request funding from the GME, but it's been unavailable or inconsistent. We look to obtain more sustainable funding, and this proposal would allow us to train 15 physicians over 5 years, per year cost being $240,000 and a total of $1.2 million. We appreciate the past support from the legislature and hope the legislature will invest in our program going forward, because we are truly a statewide resource that expands the workforces of physicians trained in addiction, and hence can reach populations most in need of addiction care. I also want to mention the incoming set of fellows and how important it is for us as a fellowship to reach out to rural communities. One of our incoming physicians into the fellowship is in practice in Red Lake, Minnesota. And then the other physician coming in is an African-American woman who's very much dedicated to serving the African-American community. Thank you again for the committee's time, and I can answer any questions after Dr. Graham's testimony.
Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee, Dr. Graham. Please say your name, and I hope I got that right. Please say your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I just want to make sure that my voice is coming through well. My name is Brian Graham. I am in clinical practice at Hennepin County Medical Center, focusing on the care of people with substance use disorders, as well as the social, medical, and psychiatric conditions that often occur together. And thank you for allowing me to testify today on House File 3552, which would provide needed short-term funding for the only addiction medicine fellowship in the state. As Dr. Specker mentioned, I am a graduate of the fellowship, and the training that it provided has been critical to my ability to lead Hennepin Healthcare's Integrated Opioid Addiction Care, ECHO. And ECHO programs consist of a hub consisting of an interdisciplinary team of specialists, which connect with spokes that typically include providers in rural or underserved areas, or primary care providers who do not have the specialized training to treat a particular illness, who connect to the hub through regular video conferences for didactic and case-based learning. We educate community providers across Minnesota on how to better manage their complex patient populations in their own communities while developing additional knowledge and expertise. And education and support for providers who care for patients with problematic opioid use, including addiction and other substance use disorders, has been an incredibly valuable asset for our state during the opioid crisis. 2018 to 2020, we educated over 1,000 healthcare professionals, ranging from physicians to licensed nurse practitioners and registered nurses, from 202 clinics across 68 counties. The fellowship also led me to partner with Dr. Cresta Jones from the University of Minnesota, who is the only physician in the state to be board certified in both addiction and obstetrics. In 2021, we hosted a seven-month series on prenatal and maternal health during our ECHO because of growing concerns around substance use in that critical period for child and family development. This is our highest attended ECHO series yet, with over 274 individual attendees hailing from 118 clinics, and has sparked numerous carry-on initiatives. We continue to offer expertise to community providers across the state that would otherwise be difficult to obtain. But we're stretched thin. Right now, the rate-limiting factor for us to expand ECHO is actually the lack of addiction-trained physicians and specialists. The need in this area is so great that we're launching a standalone prenatal and maternal health ECHO led by Dr. Jones and another reproductive psychiatrist, Dr. Katie Thorsen, starting April 12th, although we can only support it for about 12 months with current funding. Yet, as much as ECHO is making an important difference across the state, we need more physicians trained in addiction medicine. My training from the fellowship enabled me to provide this service, ranging from prenatal care to maternal care all the way through the lifespan, because of the fellowship that I did in Minnesota. We need more fellowship-trained experts who can care for people struggling with substance use disorders across the state. In the past few weeks alone at HCMC, we've been receiving 35 to 50 referrals per week from people looking for help. I just received a call just 2 weeks ago, if we could care for a 13-year-old who overdosed because the community providers weren't sure what to do and they looked for specialty training. There remains a desperate need for these specialty trained physicians, and unfortunately, we need a sustainably funded fellowship to provide these critical services. So I hope to consider this file to train another 15 physicians in 5 years so we can reach these patients and other providers that are looking for help. So thank you to Chair Bernardi for hearing the bill and to Representative Cagle for offering this legislation again. I'm available for questions as well afterwards. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We have member questions. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Specker, welcome to the legislature. Representative Cagle, thank you for bringing this bill forward. This is quite literally, I think, one of my favorite pieces of legislation I've heard in this committee. So kudos to you, doing a solid for the people at University of Minnesota as well as HCMC. For the testifier, and I'm not sure if Dr. Specker would like to respond, or even Representative Cagle, but we've heard a lot about a global opioid settlement between the various producers. And I know that the money here is coming out of the general fund, but in terms of the offset for the money that the opioid manufacturers are going to be settling with the attorneys general, Minnesota is going to receive part of that. So I'm just wondering if the amount of money that is coming into the state could supplant the money that would be coming out of the general fund, or quite honestly, enhance your efforts to train up even more physicians to provide services to those that are really reeling from the scourge of the opioid epidemic. So to either the doctor or to Representative Cagle, if you could respond to that. Thank you.
Representative Cagle, how would you like to handle that?
I can respond to that, Madam Chair.
Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Albright. So that settlement money is actually, there's a piece of legislation, but House File 400 made it so that settlement money from 2019, that settlement money goes into account, and then it is currently under statute, it's in a lockbox until that account hits $250 million. We're looking for some statutory changes this year so that we can release that money as soon as it gets into the state. But this, so they could go, and then that money then gets sent to the Opioid Epidemic Response Advisory Council for competitive grant making as well to county and tribal entities. And so that settlement money was really, House File 400 in 2019 thought about that settlement money kind of, you know, into the future. And so that's, that money is in that lockbox account. Once we get access to that money, then HDMC could apply through the ORAC competitive grant process to help supplement some of the funding for this program.
Dr. Specker.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. The only other thing I would like to add is in my conversation with the chair of that opioid committee is much of the funds were already earmarked for other things. And so when I said, yes, you know, this would make sense, can we apply for this, pursuing all avenues that we can come up with? And the response at that time, now this was about a year ago, was no, there really aren't any funds and we may release an RFP, but it was not in the works.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Specker, thank you for doing the work that you do over there, and give my very best to my good friend, Dr. Tolar, when you see him next.
Thank you. I will.
Representative Christensen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Cagle, for bringing this. I share Representative Albright's appreciation for what you're doing here and how we should continue to do more and more. The importance of this program in order to look at addiction as not just one entity, but that, you know, not only the physical addiction, but that most often every person that is suffering from some sort of addiction has mental health issues, and the two cannot be separated. And so this bill will really help to be able to have folks around in treatment centers and in treatment programs to be able to help with medications, et cetera. So, you know, I really, really do appreciate you doing this. And, you know, I hope we can do a lot more of it. So thanks much.
Okay. Is there any further discussion? Representative Cagle, do you have any closing comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I just think this is, you know, a really good bang for our buck. We need to make sure that we get enough providers that are waivered so that they can give medicated assisted treatments. And just, we need to, you know, we've seen the overdose rates increase as prescribing rates have decreased. And so there's something going on, and we need to make sure that, you know, we're putting all our chips out on the table and then getting people the help they need. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Cagle, and to our testifiers. Hearing no further discussion, I will renew my motion that House File 3552 be laid over for possible inclusion. The bill is laid over. Thank you, Representative Cagle. Now next we have on the agenda is House File 4473. Representative Hansen, we have 20 minutes scheduled for the bill, and we will plan to wrap up about 4 o'clock or 4:05. And I will move the House File 4473 be laid over for possible inclusion. We have before us House File 4473. Representative Hansen, please present your bill to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, fellow committee members. I'm looking forward to presenting this bill today. The Minnesota Reconnect program was launched in 2018, and it was sunset in 2021. The program helps people aged 25 to 60 who've been out of college for more than 2 years after they'd earned 15 or more credits, but did not complete their degree. It was started at 4 institutions and expanded to 9 in 2020. The program supports the specific needs of adult students, like support in securing childcare and transportation, employment, food, and financial resources. Each college has a point person who can help adult students navigate the resources available and walk them through the re-enrollment process. The The Minnesota Reconnect program offers these supports for adult students, and they are so important and meaningful. And it was supports like this that helped me go back to school and are a big reason why I am here on this committee serving with you in the capacity I am today. I'm a first generation college graduate wholly because I went to a university that supported me as an adult student. So today we don't have any testifiers, but in addition to being your colleague, I will be also testifying about the importance of these sorts of services. These services changed the trajectory of my life. And my story is so similar to many other adult students who will benefit from the reinvestment in the Minnesota Reconnect program. I dropped out of high school when I was 16 years old. At 17, I became a mom. And at 19, nearly 19, I graduated from high school. I tried to go right into college, online college following high school, but by the time I got to my third semester, it was too much. I had a toddler and two jobs, and finding the time and energy to do my schoolwork proved impossible. I dropped out and I worked hard to provide for my daughter while repaying the student loans I'd taken out. Then the economy crashed. We lost our housing and I relied even more on my second income. So needless to say, going back to college was not really an option. And it wasn't a risk that I was comfortable taking. I had worked in a corporate setting for a few years by this point, and during that time, I was surrounded by people with college degrees, and they made more money than me doing the same job because they had college degrees. My lack of college education produced a ceiling that I needed a degree to break through. My peers encouraged me to go to college, said they thought it would be a good fit, but I really needed more help and support than what I could find. No one in my family had ever gone to college, let alone graduated from college. I had never stepped foot on a college campus, and I did not know the first thing about transferring credits or getting transcripts from my previous colleges and my online college venture. Going back to school just felt too complicated, and I didn't even know where to start. After having my second child in my mid-20s and starting the process of purchasing a home, I decided to try the leap again and go back to college. I met with an enrollment specialist at a private university that offered a degree program that was specifically designed for adult students. The classes were offered in the evenings and weekends, and they had resources to help overcome the barriers that adult students like me often face. They offered help with transportation or securing childcare, financial assistance with emergencies, and there were support groups of other student moms. There were resources to help with food support and grants, and there were people who were committed to helping us navigate the college experience. We had parent support groups that hosted equipment swaps, like we traded baby swings for big wheels and dollhouses. And they had back to school gear for our kids, car seat clinics, and family friendly events that made our kids feel like they too were part of the university community. These resources and supports helped me feel safe enough to take the risk to re-enroll in school as a young professional mom with a new mortgage and a whole lot to lose. The supports that I received were from a private university, and St. Kate's and many other schools offer these services, but not all schools offer them, and it's often a funding battle to do so. It's my hope that we can revitalize the Minnesota Reconnect program so that more students have the supports that I had from St. Kate's. These resources were extremely meaningful to me and people with stories like mine. I'm one of many students who benefit when we invest in programs like Minnesota Reconnect. And students at more universities deserve more access to services like what I had at my private university. These services were literally invaluable to me. Like I mentioned originally, the program can help with navigating the college system, securing food transport, securing transportation and food support, and so much more. But I want to leave you with a little testimonial about what do we mean when we say food support, and what does that actually mean to students on campus? I worked 50 plus hours a week. I did 12 to 15 hours of homework a week. I was in classes for 9 hours a week, and I commuted 3 hours a week. And with every other waking hour, I was raising my kids. As I rushed to feed my kids and then get to class, I would often forget or not have enough to feed myself too. I spent every penny I had on my kids to make sure they were well fed, well clothed, and housed. And sometimes that meant skipping a meal for me because the budget or time was just too tight. But even when I struggled to take care of myself while I took care of everything else and everyone else, I could always count on St. Kate's to offer and serve the student moms a meal between our Saturday classes. And I did more than just eat and find sustenance there. I found support and friendships. I found other people who were struggling like me and people who could help us navigate those struggles. I found other people who encouraged me to persevere when it was really hard to do so, and I did the same for them. One of my fellow cohort moms who's watching today and I are still best friends because we bonded over those meals. Knowing that I had the help if I needed it was so meaningful to me. And seeing my fellow adult students get help overcoming their barriers was meaningful. Walking across that stage together and seeing the faces of people who had struggled so hard yet benefited from a supportive school environment was meaningful. Most of us are still friends today, and we still talk about the services our university offered us and other adult students. Had more of us never returned or left school in face of those barriers, we wouldn't be the same successful professionals we are today. And in my friend group alone, there are social workers, nurses, women engineers, researchers, teachers, and a politician. And we all benefited from the supportive services that we received after returning as adult students. So thank you for hearing my story today, committee members. Thank you for listening, and I really ask you to consider supporting, reinvesting in the Minnesota Reconnect program, because it's people like me that benefit. People like me that have stories like mine. So let's invest in adult students, help more people complete their degrees, and let's pave more post-adolescence higher education pathways together. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and my comments and question are for the author. Representative Hansen, a great story. We're very proud of you and wish you the best in the future. My question, however, is why did Governor Walz not put this in his budget last year so this program could continue? Do you have data that suggests maybe it's not as worthy as it originally was? Or do you have any idea why he did not fund it in last year when we had a budget year?
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Erickson. I do not have an answer for that. I would direct your question to the governor's office. But as an adult student, I ask that this committee reinvest in these programs because, like I said, these are meaningful and important programs that we supported the investment in when we created this in 2018. And I'd like to continue that so more folks like me can receive the benefits.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Does Ms. Oliver maybe have this data that we could hear during this committee meeting?
Ms. Oliver.
Hello, Madam Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Nikki Oliver. I'm the Director of Grants and Government Relations for the Office of Higher Education. I believe you're asking me why it wasn't in the Gov's budget last year. Is that the question? Or about data for the program itself?
Oh, we would like to know why it wasn't in the budget. And yes.
But Ms. Oliver.
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, I would love to defer to the Gov's office who's not here, but actually the governor had to decide on a list of priorities. And as you all know, the governor does not just focus on one subject area. He has to build his budget for the entire state. And this just was one of those items that had not made it in amongst a number of other things. And if you all recall, there were in the original budget cuts made to the agency, which after the February forecast, those were readjusted. But there was just differing priorities based on what was presented to the governor. Not that this doesn't matter to the governor, it's just there was a whole list of things that the governor had to select from. And we do have other OHE staff here who had other questions about the program itself.
Representative Erickson, do you have a follow-up?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So Ms. Oliver, do you have any data on how many were enrolled? You know, we heard Representative Hansen's story and her success. Do you have data to show us that this program is working? Because I know a lot of money was spent on administration. I believe something like $300,000 or so. That's a lot of money to spend on administrative.
Ms. Oliver. We're not hearing.
Just going to make sure. There I go. Sorry. Madam Chair, Representative Erickson. Yes, there were over 300 students who received scholarships and participated in the program. The administrative funding that you mentioned was not just OHE. In fact, some of the funding for administrative costs were actually covered by a Lumina grant. In addition, some of that administrative funding was to Mint State itself to help with the program, and then also contracting for outreach. So it wasn't just OHE. Actually, a lot of the administrative funding for OHE was absorbed using a grant and was a small portion of that administrative funding that you mentioned.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So Ms. Oliver, how does this compare to other programs that we have that might enroll students with scholarships? Is it, you know, well-received, do you think, and beneficial, the outcome as great as that from other investments that we make?
Ms. Oliver.
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson. I do have Wendy Robinson on here who could speak more to the success of the program. I will note that the difference here between this program and other scholarships is that it wasn't just the scholarship portion. There was also infrastructure and navigators, which I think Representative Hansen mentioned having those additional supports was key to the success of the individuals.
Representative Erickson, would you like me to call on Ms. Robinson?
Yes, if she's available, that'd be helpful. Thank you.
Ms. Robinson.
Hey, for the record, my name is Wendy Robinson, and I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Programs, Policies, and Grants for the Office of Higher Education. Thank you, Chair Bernardi and Representative Erickson. You know, one thing I would note, I want to be very clear that I'm not speaking for Minnesota State or any of the Minnesota State institutions at this moment, but I do want to acknowledge that prior to coming to OHE, I was actually the Vice President of Student Affairs at Inverhills Community College, which was one of the most successful MN Reconnect sites. And so I do have some firsthand experience of seeing how that program was implemented and some of the success that did come out of that program. What I would note is that the students who were participated in the program did have higher retention rates than similarly situated students who were not members of the program. And we did see students move through, you know, return to higher education, be retained from the first semester to the second semester, and then being retained on through graduation. I think one of the challenges on assessing the success of this program, to be quite honest, is COVID-19. As with a lot of higher education data, there's kind of a COVID-19 asterisk that happens because the students who were MN Reconnect students were also some of the students who were most negatively impacted when the pandemic started. And, you know, they became parents who had children at home who were doing distance learning, and their courses shifted from on campus to, you know, online. And there were some definite challenges that I think make it a little bit murkier to see kind of what the success might have been in a different context. That being said, I know that the students who were served by this program really benefited significantly from the one-on-one help that they got from their navigators. These are students who often enter higher education with some really complicated circumstances. They have, you know, 15 credits from 5 years ago in a different major that they were studying. They have a transcript from two different institutions. You know, their SAT and ACT scores are no longer useful for placement. And, you know, they don't need to go to an orientation that's a rah-rah, here's how college works orientation. They really need that one person to sit with them and say, okay, here's everything that you have. Here's what you've done so far. All right, you've changed your mind since you were 18, and now you want to do a different pathway. Here's how those credits transfer. Here's how you kind of build out a new degree program. Also, do you know about the childcare grant? Also, do you know about the food pantry? And kind of doing that holistic wraparound services. Students in this program also typically have, not typically, but it's not uncommon for them to also have financial holds from their previous higher education experience. And so part of that funding helped them lift those holds so that they could re-enter and earn that and, you know, be on that pathway to earn a credential that will improve their economic outcomes for them and their family in the future, I think is really important. I think in the interest of being, you know, fair and transparent, though, the funds for both the scholarships and the financial holds are what make this a more expensive program than some other scholarship opportunities. And the navigator piece of it is a little bit hard to scale because the value is the one-on-one relationship and the direct assistance provided to students by somebody who's a skilled and knowledgeable representative of the institution. And it doesn't work to try to do that, you know, to do 50 students at one time. It really needs to be that one-on-one relationship with each other.
Representative Erickson, do you have a follow-up?
No, I don't, but thank you very much. And I hope that we can get updated data now that the COVID is over. And you can assess how this program is working, because we spent $860,000 for student scholarships that educated 300, as I'm understanding. And you know, that's a good start for those adults reentering. I know how complicated, you know, it can be to have credits here and credits there. I did that when I was in graduate school. So you know, there's a good reason that we have navigators, but we have to make sure that we are also providing these students with the ultimate goal of getting their diplomas and getting jobs. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I have some information from the last time, or the only time that we funded this, and that was 2019. And we appropriated $2,010,000 for the program in 2019. And if Ms. Oliver was correct, we've served 300 students with that $2 million. So that is, we've spent $6,700 per student. That's a lot. Maybe that's why the governor didn't want to re-up this. But my question to the author is, I don't see a companion in the Senate, and we are at the end of this week, we're at second deadline on Friday. So is there a path in the Senate? What's happening over there?
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Representative O'Neill, and thank you, Madam Chair. I can't comment on what the Senate is or is not going to do when it comes to education this year. I would recommend you talk to the Senate about that.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, it doesn't have a Senate companion, so I don't know who to speak to because there is no Senate author. So I would love to have a conversation with somebody, but quite frankly, there isn't. In my notes anyway, there's no Senate author. So that's problematic if we're going to move this forward. So the last thing I would say is that, you know, hearing these numbers and especially realizing that we spent $2 million to serve 300 people, which is $6,700 per person, most of that went for administration. In my notes here, it says that a participant could receive up to $1,000 to release financial holds. I don't know what else the money was for other than administrative sort of things. I guess 800 or so million or 800 or so thousand was for some kind of scholarship, which I don't really know what it was paying for, but I could see why this probably wasn't in the governor's budget again. Notwithstanding COVID and everything else, but that doesn't seem like a very good use of our funds. And I guess the last question I have for the author would be, if it was appropriated only in 2019 and we spent all of this money to stand it up, what's happened since then, since there hasn't been more money for the navigators and the administration to make this happen?
Representative Hansen.
So thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative O'Neill. So when the program was launched, it was launched at four institutions. It expanded to some additional, I believe, nine institutions in 2020. And as we expand those programs, you know, there's students who need to, you know this, I know I'm preaching to the choir when I talk to you about this, but students like myself don't just see that there's a Minnesota Reconnect program and then enroll in college, right? There's different aspects of recruiting and reaching students like myself who are not tuned into. Parents never went to college. Their parents never went to college. Like I said, I had never stepped foot on a college campus. So some of the costs that come into these things aren't just some of the typical things we see other college students needing. It's associating, it's being at job fairs. It's, in my case, I ran into a booth at the KTIS Joyful Noise concert where there was a booth for the University of Northwestern St. Paul. And there was a person who was tasked with helping students like me think that college was possible and help to reignite that flame in us. And I don't think that we're gonna see the costs, you know, in this traditional ways. That would be my answer to that. Additionally, when the programs are set and then they sunset, that's not consistent for students like this. So if I, you know, knew about this in 2018 and thought, okay, I'll get my life together, get a few things together, and then try to go back in 2020, and then the program's gone, right? And so the sustainability of these programs really matter for the inflow, if you will, of students that need to take advantage of this. And, you know, $6,700 per student may sound like a lot, but $6,700 per student to produce the education and the career opportunities that it produced for people like me and my friend group matter. And I think it's a worthy investment.
Representative O'Neill, do you have a follow-up?
Just a final comment. Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, so I guess I'm more confused because if we spend all this money for navigators and paying them to do this, and then there wasn't money, I'm not sure what those four institutions did to either keep retain them or reassign them or what exactly happened. So now I'm even more confused as to where did that $2 million go? I know we only served 300 students, which isn't a lot, but now I'm just even more confused as to what the money was spent on. Thank you, Madam Chair. That's all I have.
I see no further hands up. Hearing no further discussion, I will renew my motion that House File 4473 be laid over for possible inclusion. The bill is laid over. Thank you, Representative Hansen, and to our testifiers. Now we have the agenda. We have House File 4539 from Representative Keeler. We have the remaining part of our committee scheduled for this bill, and we will plan to wrap up by 4:30. I will move that House File 4539 be laid over for possible inclusion. We have before us House File 4539. Representative Keeler, please present your bill to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This bill came to me from workers, and that's important to me, and I wanted to uplift what they're saying when it comes to the University of Minnesota. I think that that's really important to do. What this bill, it establishes a green training program, and why I think that is important, because there's a lot of news and media that the University of Minnesota takes a lot of pride in their reduction of greenhouse gas emissions and sustainability. In these spaces, when we talk about sustainability, they make reference to sustainability can and should be accessible to everyone. In a lot of the outlines that come in the Climate Action Plan, it highlights things such as increasing sustainability staffing, making sure that we have effective policy. The one thing we're missing in this is providing the workers the resources that they need. What the workers are saying is that the U is on a mission to reduce gas house emissions, which is what we want to do. We want to protect Mother Earth and generations moving forward. What our workers are saying is that they need the tools to be trained accurately and safely to utilize the resources and the tools that they have in front of them to help with this greater goal. This bill establishes the line item for the regents to create this green training program. It establishes a committee requiring the conversation to include members from these workforce areas and make sure that we move forward in a pattern that we are training our staff to be safe and to have the tools and resources they need to create the end goal. With that, Madam Chair, I'm actually going to send it over to our testifiers, and then we'll be open for conversations and discussion questions after that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. We have with us now Ed Reynoso. Please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Edward Reynoso, I'm the Political and Legislative Director for Teamsters Local 320. You know, I just saw many of you in another committee just a little bit ago and testifying on a complete different subject. And believe it or not, you know, as Teamsters, we're so diverse on the different type of workers that we represent. We do have a substantial amount of members at the U of M system. You know, and I'll just give you an example. We represent bakers, cooks, food service workers, food aides, laborers, waste treatment attendants, grounds workers, athletic grounds workers, farm animal attendants, gardeners, maintenance, laboratory attendants, lab animal attendants, and so on and so on. And the reason I say this is because, You know, this bill is truly going to educate frontline workers, such as the ones I just mentioned, around energy conservation, waste reduction, and sustainability. Recently, we had a meeting with President Gabel, and we committed to her that the Teamsters have no problem partnering with them to reach common goals. As you may know, the U of M also recently testified that they want to be the leaders in energy conservation, waste reduction, and sustainability. We want to partner with them on this issue, working with them and fixing the gaps that these goals and these goals is our priority. You know, we truly want to see the university succeed in this mission. We believe that our members play a vital role in delivering that success. This Green Training Fund has strong support of our members, students, faculty, community groups, and many, many more. And we believe is a recipe for success. Having a labor management coalition focused on the same goals with input from workers and management has high success level rates. And we believe this is a correct direction to go in training our members and other workers at the U of M. So we appreciate your support, and we hope that, Madam Chair, you would consider putting this into your omnibus bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And now with us, we have Priscilla Trin. Welcome to the committee.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for having me. Dear Chair Bernardi and members of the committee, my name is Priscilla Trin, a graduating student at the University of Minnesota and fourth-year officer of the Food Recovery Network on the Twin Cities campus. I'm here to endorse this bill for the sake of our student body, community, and planet. There's a so-called labor shortage on campus that's being cited for everything from management shortcomings to restaurant closings. And this is simply false. With rising inflation, increased cost of living, energy prices going up, essential workers deserve their fair compensation and will not settle for less. I work with the Food Recovery Network, which is a student-led volunteer national organization. We collect surplus food from campus to donate so that we can fight food waste by keeping it out of landfills where they emit harmful greenhouse gases and instead to feed our communities. We work alongside staff to pack and weigh food before loading it onto our cars to donate in a safe and sanitary manner. Every year we collect about 5,000 pounds of food from retail locations, dining halls, and sometimes even stadiums. This is what we can do with three students, myself included, and 1 to 2 workers. Just imagine how much more food we could recover if we had a few more students and workers involved. Since the pandemic started, I haven't been able to collect food from retail and dining halls, but just last month, I stepped into the kitchens to talk with workers about starting recoveries again. And I discovered that sustainable initiatives like food recovery and waste management, such as composting and recycling, have just been sidelined because everyone is being squeezed. They no longer have the capacity or knowledge to pursue protocols that protect and feed our communities. Workers need just compensation if they are to be trained and be frontline implementers of practices that benefit us all. So that is why I am endorsing this bill. We need the infrastructure the bill provides so that workers are adequately trained to streamline processes. Student and worker relationships are key to making our university follow through on promises, and the training fund can provide the support we need to continue building those relationships. I'm asking the committee to invest in our future and provide workers the tools they deserve. Thank you for listening.
Thank you. Now, members, are there any questions? Representative Cleavorn.
Thank you. And Representative Keeler, I'd like to thank you for bringing the bill forward. I appreciate your work and commitment to this important work. And it's great to hear a student's perspective as to what's happening and how you're reducing food waste on the campus. We've heard so much this year about the needs of students and the hunger on our campus as well. So to be able to take food that is perfectly good and sanitary and safe and be able to get it to those who need nutrition is really important. So Ms. Trin, I thank you for your work in that endeavor. I think the program is a very good and solid idea, no pun intended, solid waste, but it is a good way for us to work with those students early in their careers, right, while they're in their work study programs or however they're using their time while they're students and earning money on campus to pay their tuition. They're also learning a valuable life skill. that will go with them. I mean, I think many of the lessons that we learned early in our college careers have stayed with us throughout our lives. And so getting into these practices, whether it is the composting or recycling that we do in our dining halls, or the practices that we learn as groundskeepers, they stay with us. So I thank you for bringing this bill forward, and I wholeheartedly support it. Thank you.
Okay, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm looking at a letter from the U of M, and they're saying things like this bill would be a step backwards, saying that things like the food donation, gardeners gathering leaves and yard waste for composting, custodians properly handling waste to avoid cross-contamination, recycling materials for both recycling and composting, that all of these practices have been in place for many years. They also go on to talk about their energy conservation programs, things like that. So I'm just wondering, since they wrote a letter of opposition to the bill, I'm wondering if the author could kind of speak to some of those things, and has she talked to anybody else at the U besides the Teamsters who came here and gave testimony? And do you have any response to this very long letter that came from the U?
Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative O'Neill. The U did reach out to me late yesterday to try to connect on it. Still working to find, in the middle of the other bill hearings that I've had today, to reach back out to them. I think that this is one of those examples that high level administration doesn't always know what the workers actually need. You know, that we see that a lot in different corporations and different agencies. It's not just in higher ed, it's this higher level group saying, we're doing this already, it's working really well. Instead of actually, like, I learned that as frontline workers, I think we've all been in that space that, you know, the top tier is saying we're doing these things really well, but the people who are actually asked to implement the work and to do things don't have the resources that they need. And so that's where this is coming from. I'll be following up with the U. This is going to be a bill that's laid over for possible inclusion, and we'll have, you know, more of those conversations. But at this point, this bill was really coming from the need and the lens of the frontline workers who are saying that they need more resources than what they're being provided at this time.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure that this bill really provides resources. I believe it just provides training. And maybe that's what you meant by that. But the other thing that they've said in the letter is that this is in conflict with their collective bargaining. Do you have any response to their very long explanation of how this is in conflict with their collective bargaining with their unions?
Madam Chair. Yeah, I'll send that over to Mr. Reynoso, please.
Mr. Reynoso.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative O'Neill. You know, I don't believe it's in conflict with the collective bargaining agreement, but as I said during my testimony, we're willing to sit down with the U of M and find a way to make this work. We also had, I forgot to mention that we have several letters of support from other workers, written testimony that I've submitted. It's unfortunate that the U of M would have sent that letter without reaching out and having a conversation with us. And let me tell you, I've reached out to them several times in hopes of talking about issues such as this. And again, just a week and a half ago, we had a meeting with President Gable, and we committed and she committed that we would work together on common goals. It's unfortunate to hear that they would send such a disparaging letter without having a conversation with us and without looking to find a way to work together on these goals.
Representative O'Neill.
Madam Chair, thank you. So it says something about the makeup of the training, that 50% of the employees are already part of a collective bargaining unit, and I'm sure you can take it up with them. Mr. Reynoso, I have a question for him, Madam Chair, if I could. And the question is, so you said you spoke with President Gable. Did you speak with any of the regents? And maybe help me understand, like, which level of people you were speaking to. Was it anyone in addition to the president, or maybe a couple of the regents?
Mr. Reynoso.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Neill, we had an in-depth conversation with President Gable. I reached out to their legislative staff is who I reached out to. So didn't reach out to Regents. Again, I mean, on the surface of wanting to work together on legislative matters, I would think that you'd reach out to legislative representatives. So,
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Those are some of the basic questions that I had had, and I was just kind of taken aback, as Mr. Renoso was saying, at the very strongly worded letter from the University of Minnesota. And challenging collective bargaining things. And I just was taken aback. So I just wanted to get some clarification from both him and from Representative Keeler. Thank you.
And Madam Chair, Representative
Mr. Reynoso.
I have not seen the letter. It's the first I've heard of it. I'm looking forward to reading it and maybe reaching out to them again. Thank you.
Representative O'Neill, a follow-up? Okay. Is there any further discussion? Hearing no further discussion, I will renew my motion that House File 4539 be laid over for possible inclusion. The bill is laid over. Thank you to our testifiers. And Representative Keeler. Oh, Representative Keeler, I need to back up. Representative Keeler, do you have any closing comments? I apologize for that.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This bill is just bringing forward what frontline workers are asking for. I think that it's important that we lift up voices of everybody involved. That's what we're doing. We're just trying to lift up their voices and understand that we all play a role in sustainability. We all play a role in protecting Mother Earth and the next generation. And that's what this bill does. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, so now I'm going to say, hearing no further discussion, I will renew my motion that House File 4539 be laid over for possible inclusion. The bill is laid over. We are done with our hearing today, and thank you very much for everyone who was here, our guests and our representatives. And with that, our next meeting will be Wednesday, March 30th. The meeting. Oh, Representative O'Neill, I see your hand up.
Just really quickly, since we are approaching third deadline, and I was just wondering if you give us a path as to what we'll be doing next week.
Well, Representative O'Neill, we will be having testimony on our bill next Tuesday, marking it up on Wednesday. And I just want to verify that with our committee administrator, Sean Herring.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative O'Neill, I believe that is the plan to do roll out on Monday, take public testimony on Tuesday, and then do markup and passage on Wednesday.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So great, we'll do a walkthrough testimony and then markup the next day. Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Okay, seeing no further discussion, the meeting is adjourned.